Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, in defense of True Detective Night Country. So the plan wasn't to record this episode originally. There was a horror movie on deck that I'm probably going to talk about next week, or at least poll the community about. But this is going to be our last chance to discuss True Detective Season 4 before the finale and the inevitable divisive, it was amazing, it failed, it was a complete letdown, it was genius discourse that will get unleashed across the land. But this is an exciting time because we just don't know where this long, frozen, winding road is headed. And a couple things have become really clear to me. Number one is I'm really sad to see the show end, which is a feeling that I haven't had in quite a while. Does that mean the show is perfect? No. Does that mean that it's going to end up being one of the greatest shows in the history of television? Perhaps. Depends on how good the ending is. But probably no. But it is a gift to be sad when something ends, the way so many people were sad when Twin Peaks was prematurely ended back in the day and are now sad again that Twin Peaks The Return happened. And even though it had a perfect conclusion, they're sad because it's just human nature to crave more of something that you love. I'm going to miss spending time in Ennis, Alaska. I'm going to miss the characters and the sense of mystery. And that's just not something that most television seasons, even ones that may have been better crafted than this one, are able to achieve. It's a special thing. Number two, I talked about True Detective once on this podcast before, or this season anyway, and it was unclear how horror it was going to go. It is now clear that it's a horror show, and that is a great thing for us horror fans. It's a series, True Detective is a series that has been taken over by Issa Lopez, who is a horror director, or at least that's how I primarily know her. Nick Pizzolatto, who created True Detective, isn't a horror person. There might have been horror elements, there might have been cosmic horror things going on. It felt a lot more noir than horror. This is not, this is a takeover by horror, by the horror genre of a very well-known IP. And no matter how else you feel about it, if you're one of those people who are super disappointed by season four or are just baffled by it or bored by it or however you're taking it, if you're a horror fan, I would love to see more. I want to see the horror version of the end of Young Sheldon, for example. I want them to bring in Stephen King, the Stephen King circa the era he was directing Maximum Overdrive, and I want to see him direct the season finale of Young Sheldon. I want to see a satanic and mysterious version of Fire Country. As a horror fan, how could you not want these things? So we now, at least for a time, as horror aficionados, own True Detective, and I think that's a good thing. How can one not? There's an author I truly admire and respect and recommend to no end named Laird Barron. I think there's a legitimate argument you could make that he is the most talented horror writer born after 1970, let's say. He's written a lot of incredible works, both novels and short stories. He's equally adept at both. He's on Paste Magazine's most anticipated horror novels of 2024. That book is called Not a Speck of Light. The cover of it is amazing. Now, this man grew up in Alaska in his early years. It was an exceedingly harsh environment, according to his biography. His family lived in very isolated areas, no surprise for Alaska. He raced the Iditarod three times in the early 1990s. He worked as a fisherman on the Bering Sea. He had a very scary near-death experience in the last year. Every horror author I can think of that I admire, besides perhaps Stephen King, I didn't see it, and maybe he's just on a scale where he didn't notice it, was trying to raise funds for the medical help of Laird Barron, who thankfully is doing really well, it seems, now. And he has one eye. He wears a eye patch. I mean, maybe he has two eyes, but he wears an eye patch. So I suspect there's just one, which ties in thematically in a scary appropriate way to True Detective Night Country. So why am I bringing this up? Well, he loves season four of True Detective. And, you know, in this age, there are just very few like critics or reviewers that you can turn to. I have a couple. There's a couple of podcasters. There's a few writers. And I mean writers of reviews, not like horror fiction authors, who I would like 100% trust in a review to be like, okay, if you say it's great, that means it's going to be great. We just don't have that kind of thing that much anymore. But, and what that means is that when it's not a critic, when it's someone who's a practitioner of the craft of creating something in the genre that they're talking about, in this case, horror, especially if they have an extremely pertinent background, i.e. someone who lived in Alaska. He is active on Twitter. I won't call it the other name. I refuse. But he's got a great sense of humor. One of his recent tweets was after the trailer for Twisters came out in the Super Bowl, he tweeted, "Nice to see human beings outrunning tornadoes in the Twisters trailer. America, fuck yeah." But anyway, he loves Night Country, and he's one of the few voices that I would trust to be like, okay, is this something, does this thing have a legitimate chance to be an all-timer, to be great? He had a tweet recently about Jodie Foster where, and this is after watching Night Country, in reference to Night Country, I'm sure his old Earl career too, but like, this is what prompted it. He tweets, "Jodie Foster is legendary, reminds of a champion boxer, warms up in the early rounds, makes it look close, starts showing more life with snappier jabs, a hook here, a counter there, seems to take a middle round or two off, then ka fucking bam, lights out, right cross." He also tweeted on February 5th that he hadn't seen True Detective season 4 yet, had only seen the trailers and a few comments, and he wanted to throw a dart in the dark prediction. He said, "Prehistoric parasite making folk lose their minds and cosmic horror fans will be sad." That's very interesting because I think that's very much still in play as a possibility. Now, there are going to be spoilers galore for episode 5, the penultimate episode of True Detective Night Country. We only have one more episode to go. So if you care about spoilers and you haven't seen it yet, please go visit the Night Country. And then if you make it out alive, come back and listen to the rest of this episode. There were two other episodes between the last time I addressed this season on the podcast. I'm not really going to talk about those. I'm going to talk about season 5. One, because it's fresh in my head. And two, it's because it's what sold me on doing this episode in the first place. Okay, so let's drill down on a couple things here. The horror element is being executed better than a lot of just straight up explicit horror series in a lot of interesting, maybe hard to catch even ways sometimes. Example, Jodie Foster's character, Liz, is the sheriff of the small town. Her investigation into the murder of the Salal scientist is getting shut down by the powers that be. She kind of gives up on the investigation. She's been pushing, but it just doesn't seem like it's going anywhere. She's got so little support. Even the few people that she works with are under enormous strain, or she just actively a lot of times seems to dislike them. I think that's surface. I think she really cares about them underneath, but it's not easy for her, you can tell. And when she gives up on the investigation, her partner, for lack of a better description, or at least partner in the investigation, Navarro, presses onwards. Her own daughter says a great line of just a real simple, "I haven't given up on you, Liz." And her daughter, Leah, lets her know that the mine, Silver Sky Mine, that has been poisoning the town slowly with bad water is the thing we're seeing. Who knows if there's other things they've unleashed here in terms of biological or even supernatural terror, let alone covert killings and assassinations and what other shady things that they're doing. There have been a lot of stillbirths in the town, and we have spent a good amount of time with people. Annie Kay, one of the first really the killing that kind of centers the whole series, or the murder that centers it. She was a midwife. One of the season episodes opens with a midwifing event. There's a lot of mother elements in the series. It's one of the like things you notice most is it's either hard to be a mother or the mothers are gone. They're just not there for a lot of the people. So Leah tells her mom that these stillbirths are happening, and Jodie Foster goes to the place where they're keeping the children's bodies in creepy little children-sized coffins in cold storage. And when she gets there, the person running the place tells her that the ground is too cold because it's the season of night, of endless night right now in Ennis. The ground is too cold to even crack to bury the children. They're just being stacked in this place. Now, this is a horrifying enough situation, and Jodie Foster standing there among these tiny coffins is a very haunting scene in its own right. What Night Country is doing that's special in terms of horror terms, I mean, one of the ways, is we have now had it drilled into our heads as attentive viewers, if you've been watching the season, that people in Ennis routinely see the dead. And that's when I got a chill, like a chill down my back that stayed there for the remainder of the episode, when I realized that there were grieving moms out there and parents. But like Leah says, those are moms. There have been 9 stillbirths. That's 9 moms, Liz, she says to her. There are moms out there who might be seeing their barely ever having existed children in terms of hallucination or nightmare, or maybe they're just seeing them. And the show doesn't point that out to us. It doesn't like make that happen. Thankfully, it doesn't visualize it for us. But it reminds me of that haunting scene of the kid floating outside the window for Salem's Lot. That's what I started picturing in my head, but for like just an even more like no age child. I remember I hung out in cemeteries a lot as a kid, as someone who would end up hosting a podcast called Horror Weekly would. I've been in a lot of cemeteries, and one of the very first cemeteries I ever hung out in, I stumbled across this area, and it was called, it had a sign that said Babyland, and I never forgot it. One of the most scarring things I've ever seen as a kid, I was really young, realizing what this place was and what it meant. I hadn't seen an area of a cemetery dedicated explicitly to that age before. And this is so long ago, and I can still picture it in my mind's eye. There's something so tough, so unfair, so haunting about that concept. And Night Country has gone there. It's done that. And this is something that even quote-unquote hardcore or extreme horror can't get close to in a way that's both a justice to it, but also unflinching look at it. So despite the fact that this season is thronged with creepy ghosts and scary apparitions and spooky atmosphere and has all the trappings you would expect from a show that really wanted to go into a horror realm, it's also doing it in a deeper, more sophisticated and touching kind of way. And that's rare. And that's special. Now, this might be reading too much into it. Who knows? Shows like this invite that sometimes. And as a Twin Peaks being my favorite TV show of all time, it's something that a Twin Peaks fan would be predisposed to do anyway. I finally noticed something from the opening credits. So it seems obvious in a show where nature seems to be striking back or planning some kind of revenge or building to some kind of crescendo of revenge, and a show where a mine, which is, and a lab, which is coring, drilling deep cores into the surface of the planet to search for things, that the invasion of Earth, the chopping into the ground, so to speak, is a violent thing to the planet. And that's when I noticed in the opening credits that there are things driven into the ground vertically through the entire credit sequence. I don't know how I didn't see it before. The poles that go into the ground to, with the reflectors that light the way of the road, the struts of bridges, the core samples themselves, electric poles, telephone poles, the ground of Ennis in the opening credits to the show is just riddled with things that humans have pounded into the earth for their own purposes. And there's a vertical versus horizontal grid kind of element going on in True Detective, I think, that is really kind of mind-blowing to me. Because in the opening sequence, in the opening credits, you see a lot of people going down below, like, let's say, the horizon line of the screen into the water. So you're above water, you're above ground, then you're below water, then you're above ground, then you're below water. And you're either up or down. And then even the idea of when you die, you get buried or dropped into the ground or you walk into the ocean like a lot of characters in this season are trying to do. Or in the case of, and we're going to get to this a second because it's one of the most haunting scenes I've ever seen in a series, when someone is cremated, the smoke from the cremation goes up. It's like part of you escapes a little bit. That gravity of you're getting forced down by death into the ground, into the water. Death is like sinking, but in cremation, it's a little bit like rising. So that's when it was a mind boggling to me when I was puzzling through this above or below. You're either above the line and you're still going, you're still breathing, you're still striving, you're still trying to make your life work, or you're below the line, which means you're in the ground, you're in the water, it's over for you. That the very last shot of the opening credits is a car whose headlights are focused on us. There's a car in the distance and it's perfectly situated on that middle line. It's not above, it's not below, it's dead center in the middle. And that's where all the characters we've cared about, if we like the show, through the whole season, primarily Peter, who I think in some respects is stealing the show, but Liz and Navarro and Kavik, like all these characters that we have come to love, they're all right there dead in the middle. They can't rise. They're stuck. Every time they try to make an advance in a relationship, something knocks them down. They try to make an advance in their career, something blocks them. They try to make an advance into solving the mystery, and then something turns out to be a red herring or wrong or incomplete. But they're not below. They haven't sunk. They haven't given up. They haven't been beaten into the ground. They haven't been dropped into the caves or the ice or the night country. They're still right there hanging on, hanging tough in the middle. And that's super interesting to me because I know from browsing things online that there are a lot of people who are really frustrated with this season, who even given up on the season or gave up way back. And one of the reasons that they've cited for that is their frustration as viewers that we don't seem to be getting anywhere. And although I'm sympathetic to feeling like you're getting trolled or jerked around by a show that keeps throwing out mysteries and then not advancing anywhere, like I see these memes of, you know, the True Detective Night Country's plot has never advanced, where every episode happens and we're just left exactly in the same place that we were. But I'd like to posit that experience is mirrored by the character's experience. And a show where you are, as a viewer, situated in exactly the same place and environment and maddening frustration as the characters themselves mean that you're living it with them. And I think that might be a key that unlocks one of the secrets of why, if you hate the show or if you've given up on the show or whatever, God knows why you're listening to this episode then. But if you have, and you have a friend or a family member or someone you know who loves the show, maybe this is one reason why. A lot of shows feel like you're experiencing them from a distance, but to the people who love this show, they might kind of be living it. And that's not an everyday occurrence with a TV show. Now, the very first scene and the first visuals we get of episode 5 of Night Country are astonishing. They are breathtaking. And it's not show-offy. It's not in any way flashy, which makes it even more remarkable. And I don't think I've ever seen this. As many horror movies as I've watched, the closest I can think of are scenes from Return of the Living Dead. But we are experiencing the POV of being inside a crematorium, inside a cremation of someone who's passed away, in this case, Navarro's sister. We are in there with the ashes, with the heating element and the fire. And we're looking out as if we're the dead person, as if we're the one getting cremated. And we're looking at the door that seals the crematorium. And in that door is a small porthole window. And the camera has pulled back just enough where you just see this heap of burning ashes and then this circle of light. And I swear to God, it looks like being at a campfire in the middle of the night, with the wood, with the logs burning in front of you, and a moon up in the sky. It's the most unnatural, natural image I can imagine. It looks like being out in nature at a campfire, staring up at a beautiful moon, but it's in a stainless steel area with nothing natural, just ashes and steel and glass. And for the life of me, I don't know if this is intentional, but intentional or not, it is absolute greatness. One of the most gripping beginnings to an episode I have in my recent memory. And then we watch the entire process of the cremation, the timers being set, the switches being flipped, the ashes being scooped out of the crematory, whatever that is, pod, whatever you call it. And then being like, they use like a scoop that you would see in a restaurant, like next to an ice bin. They use a scoop to scoop the ashes and like just put them into the urn. We see the urn get closed, and then the camera pans over and Navarro, the sister of the dead person, Officer Navarro, is standing right there. She's been watching the entire process, and that's like an emotional gut punch. The crematory operator asks her to sign a form, then tells her, please don't tell anyone that I let you kind of be this close to the process, assuming that's, you know, against protocol. And then she lets her take the urn away with the remains of her sister. And she tells her, because this just happened, the ashes just came out, be careful, it's hot. And the transition from when she hands the urn over saying, there she is, here, there she is, hun, I think is what she says to Navarro. The transition from she to now it's hot is bone chilling. It's blood curdling to just in the space of moments to go from being referred to as she as a human to an it as a jar and ashes is terrifying. And then Navarro picks up the urn and hugs it. And I'm telling you, Navarro, this acting, this performance, this character is so believable, I almost refuse to believe she doesn't exist. I almost refuse to believe that it's acting. I can't even imagine a circumstance of seeing someone collecting the remains of a sibling and clutching them to their chest and holding on to that for dear life and trying not to let, you know, all the emotions break free, trying to not let the memories all escape. I refuse to believe it wouldn't like look exactly like what I'm seeing in this scene. Just extraordinary stuff. Now, there are elements happening in this season that are, it's going to sound pretentious, forgive me, just because it's my favorite creator who's ever existed, like the one who's meant the most to my life, Shakespeare. It's almost Shakespearean. There are all these ghosts and apparitions pointing their fingers at Navarro. I'm taking this as they're pointing at her because they're reminding her or representative to her of all her guilt. And that is a pure Shakespeare move. This is the ghost of Banquo showing up at Macbeth's coronation feast. These are ghosts who just show up to literally haunt you, to remind you, whether they're there or not, whether it's in your mind's eye or they're actually there, the accusatory fingers they're pointing at you, that blanket of guilt feeling that they bring every time they're on the screen. This is something, if Shakespeare came back and this was being performed on a stage and ghosts were pointing to a character like this, he'd be like, I know exactly what you're doing. This is also a season that's smart enough to leave us some blank spaces and some breathing room as viewers. Like, for example, after Navarro's sister unalives herself, Navarro gets in the car. She tells Jodie Foster that this happened. She gets in the car. Jodie Foster looks in the backseat and the urn is there, heartbreakingly strapped in with a seatbelt like a little child would be. And Jodie Foster in the passenger seat looks at Navarro and says, "Do you want to talk about it?" And Navarro pauses for a second, looks her dead in the eye and says, "No." And then they just drive. And you get these beautiful, absolutely gorgeous. I don't think I've ever seen snow look this gorgeous in like a non-classic black and white movie, in a modern color setting, especially since, look, let's be honest. This show is called Night Country, right? What are we as horror fans or as movie fans in general always complaining and griping and bitching about in recent years? Everything's too dark. For some fucking reason, everything's too dark. Whether it's streaming compression or whatever, you can't see Godzilla 2014. 80% of the scenes are too dark. Nothing's ever lit appropriately in movies anymore. This entire series is set in a place that's getting no sunlight, but everything glows. Everything's lit amazingly. Everything's in sharp contrast. I mean, come on. But we have this grieving sister driving down the road with her friend, anti-friend, and she's not talking about her grief. She's not explaining to us. There's no like elaborate rust cold metaphors going on here. They're just driving, and it's the surroundings. It's the snow washing almost everything out. It's the dark road. It's the headlights struggling to even cast light a couple feet forward before they die. It's the somber look of all the nature around them that tells us that they're grieving. They didn't have to fucking talk about it in this case. There are times in the season where people talk about stuff, but the show is smart enough to know we don't always need that. Sometimes just two people driving down a road in a heartbreaking condition with unspoken stuff happening between them, especially if they're both great actors, which in this case they are, that's perfect. It's all we need. A scene towards the end of this episode when Jodie Foster comes back from seeing the coffins reinvigorated and marches into her office. Or actually, I don't know if it's exactly that scene. Forgive me. There's a scene in this episode where she's in her office or in a room and the blinds are behind her And the snow, it looks more magical than I've seen snow in the last maybe decade of film. And it's funny because there's a really touching scene in this episode when Hank is strumming a guitar and singing a song with really bleak, depressing lyrics. And the song says, "There is no king," which is interesting because a lot of people are speculating there's ties to the Yellow King. We might have a Blue King here. Blair might be the Blue King. There's a lot of theories. But the song lyrics explicitly said, "There's no king, no one will be crowned." Interesting. But it also says, "There's no star, she's falling down." And this scene with Jodie Foster, it's only a couple seconds long, this moment, not scene, with the snow glittering behind her, just looks like all the stars have fallen out of the sky and are dropping all around her office in Ennis. It's gorgeous. It's ravishing. And there's these little graceful touches of indicating to us what people's relationships are really like. There's this moment where Hank's singing his song to himself. It's a very Twin Peaks moment. The strumming the guitar, the singing lyrics that have oblique references to what's going on in the show, but are not explicit. Very, very David Lynch. And while the song's playing, his son, Pete, walks outside around the corner and hears his dad singing this song. And he leans against the wall out of sight, so his dad doesn't know, and listens to him perform this entire song. And then sadly walks away and then calls him because he's been thrown out of his house for being too involved, too consumed by the police investigation and not being a good enough husband. Everyone's paying a price for this, what the mine is doing to the town, but also like whatever crime has happened to Annie and the scientists that have been killed. He calls him and says, "I need a place to stay. Can I crash with you?" And he asks his dad, "What are you doing?" And Hank says, "I'm working on my car. Like, not sitting here strumming sad songs to myself on a guitar." And his son, who's literally just right around the corner, who's just there, says, "Okay, great. Thank you. I'm about 5 minutes away." He did this to not embarrass his dad, right? He didn't like knock on the window and, "Haha, what are you singing?" He didn't walk in and interrupt it. He pretended to be further away than he was. He never brings it up again. It's just such a nice touch of Pete's character. And we find out later in the episode, there's a theory that Leah, Liz's daughter, has that Pete sacrificed a moment of sports glory to help someone in need to feel better. And she's convinced that he did it. He denies that he did it, but I don't believe it at all. I think he did. And she says something really interesting, Noam. She says, "That person that did that, that sacrificed that moment and made themselves look like a failure or an idiot publicly to let someone else feel good because they knew they needed it, that's the person your wife fell in love with. Don't let Liz, the sheriff, and by inference, this case, this murder investigation, destroy that man. Keep that man, whoever that Pete Pryor, whoever that one is that did that, don't lose that person." And it's just like one of the best pieces of advice in a TV show you can imagine. Just sheer absolute blast of wisdom from like a really young character. And these little moments, these little touches, they're not all for the good in the relationships. Like when Hank meets Kate, who's running the Silver Sky Mine, in a car, and she gives him the mission to go kill Otis Heiss, and it leads to the horrifying ending of this episode. When they're sitting in the car, the fact that she calls him Henry and not Hank, the fact that she's threatening and bullying, but also like appealing to him, saying, "I'm counting on you, but you got to do this." The fact that everything they say to each other means the opposite. She says, "You know, this is something that has to be taken care of." And he's like, "I'm not a killer." She's like, "I didn't say to kill him. I need you to say out loud that you know I did not say the words, kill him." And then later in the conversation, she goes, "He's a drug addict. They get lost." I mean, she's telling him to kill him, but it's opposite talk, right? So poor Hank is stuck in this place where his son is not really his son. He's not really a father, even though he's a father. He's not acting or functioning or behaving like a father. He wants to become a husband. He's been ditched by his con artist, Russian mail order bride, or he conned himself. I mean, really, it was so obvious what was happening there. But everything in his life is opposite. He wanted to be police chief. He was promised to be police chief. If he did crimes, he did the crimes. He didn't get to be police chief. Everything is coming out opposite for this guy. And the fact that he's sitting in a car being called a different name than anyone else calls him, being told to do something by not being told to do something, being promised that he's going to get something that we know he's not going to get, is another way, like brushstrokes in a painting, that this season is showing us through the relationship of two characters what their true state actually is. Now, I've been talking about this like it's Nosferatu or like some ultimate masterpiece, and these are all the great things I'm seeing in it that are making me enjoy it, that are making me want to fight for it on a podcast episode. And I think that's primarily what a podcast episode should do when you're in the mood to do it. Like when you think it needs to be done, or you're not seeing it being spoken about that way, in that way elsewhere. Does that mean that I think it's perfect? Absolutely not. There are some weird moments that are way too on the nose. There are some like moments that frustrate even me as someone who enjoys a slow burn or a deep mystery or following red herrings down a path. And the show is also going to be unusually based on how it sticks the landing or doesn't stick the landing. I mean, the ending of this thing, and this gives me all kinds of fears, because it's legendary what happened to the original Twin Peaks when David Lynch did not want to reveal the mystery of who killed Laura Palmer. And they forced the series to do it. And the series tried to carry on after that reveal, and it was a disaster at the time. The episodes that followed that reveal are the weakest of the greatest TV show of all time. They're the weakest episodes until David Lynch came back and directed the most ferocious fuck you ending to a series, at least the conclusion at that time, that has ever been done and will probably never be topped. So the disappointment that people had after the reveal makes me really worry about where True Detective Night Country is heading, because I don't know that I need the mystery reveal to blow my mind for me to be extremely satisfied with the series ending. It would be nice, but I've come to regard the characters so much, at least the ones I care about. And this is weird, because in a lot of horror, the ones you hate or the ones you're supposed to hate, like the villains like Freddy Krueger, Michael Myers, they become almost beloved. And you really care about how they're treated and how they're portrayed. The characters I hate in this series, at least the ones I know of so far, I don't give a flying fuck about. I don't care what happens to Mining Kate. Couldn't care less. Connolly, the guy who's helping the mine shut down Navarro's investigation. Great actor, really fun when he's on the screen. I don't care. That guy could like fall off the face of the fucking planet. wouldn't matter to me one way or another as a viewer. But the characters, and that's weird because, you know, like I said, in horror, a lot of times you care about both the villains and the heroes, or at least the survivors, or the strivers. But in this case, I feel completely indifferent about the quote unquote bad characters. But I do love the good characters. And if they pay them off, if they pay their relationships off, and that doesn't mean a happy ending at all. I mean, I'm very into bleak endings. But as long as they make it feel like getting to know these people was worth the journey, and when we leave these people, we see that there was a point to that journey with them as characters and to each other. Like, in a weird way, I almost am more concerned that the series ending or the season ending pays off what these people mean to each other. I feel like after the conclusion, after the final episode, if I could get the characters, not the actors, but the good characters I care about in a room And I was like, can you explain to me how you all really feel about each other now, knowing what you know? And they could convincingly do it, I would be happy with the ending of the series. I mean, the doing a payoff to the mystery and who the killer is, or killers, or supernatural forces, Sedna, the goddess of the underworld, or whatever. Is it Three-Fingered Blair? Is it Kavik? I hope not. God help us. But if the mystery pays off in an amazing way, that will be amazing. If it's a complete fail, and I think a lot of people forget, because True Detective Season 1 has become so legendary over time, that we hadn't met the killer barely at all in the entire series, or the entire season. He was just the guy on a lawnmower. So, you know, people were like, oh my God, if the killer of this season is Blair, we've only seen her like a couple times. What a fake out that would be. I mean, that's what season one did. So I don't know if I can hold that against it, but the problem is that you're replaying a move that a legendary season in the same franchise did before. And I'm not sure that's going to sit well with me if that's how this ultimately goes. But I guess what I'm saying is I'm more concerned about the emotional payoff on the character level than the mystery level. And the odds of an episode pulling off both in a season that feels like it should have been 8 episodes and not 6. We might be looking at a final season Game of Thrones situation here, where they had ideas, but they just didn't have the space and time to execute them. And that would make me very sad. But we'll see. And we'll see how daring they're going to be. If they're too explicit about explaining everything, they run the risk of what Twin Peaks was forced to do. If they go the Sopranos screen going black, not explain anything, almost everyone's going to hate it, right? So, and if they go middle ground, it feels not brave enough. So I don't know. They might have played themselves into a corner here. We're going to find out. The excellent prestige TV podcast that the Ringer Network does had a really illuminating episode of their own on episode 5 of Night Country. And they touched really briefly on some Greek mythological tie-ins. They were saying that if you say it really fast and kind of smudge it together, the character Otis Heiss sounds like Odysseus, who's the character in Greek mythology who kind of like wanders the world and finds things and makes his way through mazes and spirals, let's say. And two of his most famous episodes of, or heroics or things that he went through in mythology are, one, he confronted the Cyclops, which is pretty notable because there's a lot of one-eyed shit going on here. We got one-eyed bears. When we meet Blair, the first time she's holding an ice pack on her face so we can only see one eye. We got a lot of one-eyed. There's a bunch more, but we got a lot of one-eyed action going on here. So the Cyclops element feels like a plausible, at least mythological echo that the series might be working in. And then one of Odysseus's other famous moments is going to the underworld. And since we're definitely heading into the Night Country, which are underground caves, in this last episode, there's not much I know about the last episode, but I know that's happening. Seems like this is... And considering Tigers Are Not Afraid, which is a superb horror movie that Issa Lopez did, which is really good at building in a folklorish feel without explaining it or naming it too much, I find it very believable that these are references that the episode is making that make sense to me. I think there's definitely a revenge element coming. It's possible that Annie herself has unleashed it, or it's been unleashed on her behalf, is coming. The harm that's being wrought on the town, particularly on women and children, seems like something that is getting paid back and is definitely going to get paid back more. So I know that doesn't even rise to the level of a theory. That just means that I feel like that's definitely someplace that the last episode is headed. I'm a little bit concerned that there's going to be another reveal of another character who's in on it. Now, we got one of those already with Hank. Like, Hank was undermining the investigation from the beginning. He was a spy in the House of Love, as the Doors would say. We got one of those. I would hate to see, like, Kovic or Pete or someone else turn out to be, like, an inside agent. It's going to have to be done really, really well with a really clear explanation if they try to pull that off. The characters on the edge, like characters like Clark, sure. But if Navarro or like Jodie Foster or Navarro with amnesia turn out to be like the killers or something, God, I just don't know. To Laird Barron's point, if all that core sampling has unleashed some kind of microorganism, like almost John Carpenter thing, but on a tiny scale style, and it's making everyone hallucinate and lose their minds or whatever, I'm open to that, honestly. Like, if it goes real horror show and they make it really scary, like, and plausible for the universe, I'm okay with it. Depends on how they execute it, right? The thing that worries me is, or not worries me, but the thing that intrigues me here is, it seems obvious when Hank and Kate were sitting in the car and they were like, we can't let them find the cave where Annie Kay was murdered. I don't think they were saying it because they couldn't find the crime scene. I mean, what kind of idiots would leave the crime scene uncleaned or untouched, especially since, and we'll get to the end of season, the episode 5, a crime scene is about to be cleaned in a horrifying way by Pete here. If Navarro and Liz and Pete can clean up a crime scene in a matter of hours, to leave Annie Kay's crime scene uncleaned after all this time is just dumb. So whatever Annie found in the cave, which is proof against the mine, I think has to be the key point. And if it's some kind of like super killer microorganism that the people who own the mine or run the mine know about, because they know that a cave cannot be found. And if the cave can't be found, not because it's a crime scene, but because of what Annie discovered in it, the question is, what did Annie discover, right? The obvious answer is she discovered that they unleashed something toxic on the town and they knew they were doing it and they didn't care for a profit. That seems like the most reasonable guess for where this is headed. But to just keep operating while some micro superorganism that makes everyone hallucinate and drives herds of caribou off cliffs and makes everyone mutter them to themselves, she's awake, I don't know about that. Now, if it's a Roswell situation, if they know that something supernatural was unleashed by them and they don't want to be blamed for it and they're covering it up that way, that is going to be on the difficult side to execute as showrunners and writers, but I think you could do it. Now, if, as some theories online suggest, if this is a revenge thing being done by the people of the town themselves, perhaps led by Blair, perhaps led by someone we don't know about, I mean, that seems like an interesting theory to me, but I just don't get at all how that ties into the cave, the night country, the spirals, and all that stuff where it's going, unless there's some kind of revenge cult based on the spiral, which doesn't make any sense to me. So, I mean, the show could be going there. I just don't see how that ties in to the reveal of what Annie discovered and what was going on in that cave. And then there's the hanging mystery of the scientist Clark, who we've only seen at the very beginning and then in flashbacks, and then probably, I'm guessing it's him, in that one chilling moment when the supply guy comes to drop off supplies at Salal Station in episode 1. And while he's walking through the station before he finds the tongue, he sees a figure run really fast, blur, sinister style through a hallway in the blink of an eye. I'm guessing that's Clark. This is where I most haven't made up my mind as to whether Clark's a villain or a hero or just another one of the lost. Like, why wasn't he killed with the rest of the scientists? Is that because he was trying to help Annie and because the female vengeance that's being unleashed by Sedna knew that he was better than the other scientists, or at least not as complicit? because the Salal station has been helping the mine hide whatever its pollution impacts on Ennis have been. So clearly the scientists there were doing the devil's work, except maybe for Clark, in which case he's not a villain at all. And then I also haven't made my mind up about Rose, who I feel like Fiona Shaw is the only actor big enough and legendary enough where we get like some kind of evil, she was behind the whole thing turn. That's how it would happen in like a mystery show, right? That's what would happen on like fucking Columbo or Murder, She Wrote or some shit, where it'd be like guest starring Fiona Shaw. And then they tried the whole episode to make us believe that they weren't the bad guy. And then of course they're the villain because they're the biggest name actor in the whole thing. Right. So, just based on Fiona Shaw herself, and her acting chops and level, I feel like she might just be coming in as like some kind of ally or agency of the evil force itself. We just don't know. I'm just guessing on her name. Nothing in her character has given us any reason to believe that. And then the last element of the mystery I want to talk about is one of my favorite Westerns, because it's really a horror Western, is, if not the horror Western, honestly, is High Plains Drifter. And in High Plains Drifter, Clint Eastwood's character, who turns out to be the reincarnation, the specter of someone who was tortured, abused, and killed in a town and has come back to wreak vengeance on that town. Sure, he's the scariest thing in the movie, and he's a ghost, so he's the horror element in the movie. Everyone else is just regular human. But he's also completely justified in his revenge. Does he go too far? Absolutely. But you feel a lot of sympathy for him. You understand why he's on the mission he's on. And the fact that he's completely wrecked this evil town is probably for the better of humanity. He's destroyed a lot of villainy. He's neutralized the town's ability to victimize other innocent people as they pass through. So, like, it's, even though he uses evil men's means, it's the means justify the ends kind of thing. And I think there's a really good chance that's where Night Country's headed. The she and she's awake might be on a mission of lawful evil. I just don't get a chaotic evil sense from where we're headed here. I get like a rebalancing of the scales, but in a really sinister and creepy way. So we shall see. Thank you so much for your patience in listening to something that I'm sure a lot of you don't consider horror. Also, isn't really on the format of this podcast, in which I'm polling the group. We're going to get back to that. I want to thank our most recent review on the Apple platform was saying that I love, I'm paraphrasing, I don't have it in front of me, but I love the format of the show best when you talk to the people and we get to vote on the Facebook page. And I agree with that. That's why I made the podcast in the first place. So we will get back to that. But the primary goal of Horror Weekly podcast and the Horror Weekly page is where people get passionate about something and really want to talk about it. That's where it happens, right? So that's why your voices are on these episodes all the time. Because I pick the ones that I feel like are the most passionate, the most insightful, or funniest, like most interesting ones, right? And, or at least of the ones I see, I can't see them all, obviously. And when the inspiration strikes me for the episode, I'm just going to go that way. And I'm just sorry. I'm sorry if it's, not consistent to the format and it drives you crazy. My deepest apologies. I mean it. I most likely will talk about the finale of Night Country on a future episode, but unless the episode is an absolute compelling masterpiece, I probably won't devote a whole other episode to it. There are other things I want to get to. I saw Lisa Frankenstein. I do not want to spoil it. I thought it was too early to talk about it anyway, because I suspect a lot of people haven't had the chance to see it yet. But I do want to cover some of that in a new episode. I want to talk about its relationship to the movie Heathers, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. One of my favorite surprise moments when Joe Bob Briggs covered Heathers on The Last Drive-In, which I thought was amazing because I hate being straitjacketed by the "it's not horror, so we can't talk about it" thing. I saw a really interesting horror movie that just came out called Double Blind, and I want to talk about that. So there's just a lot to get to. I hate to root against True Detective sticking in the landing, but I almost don't want to devote another full episode to it. And unless the season finale of Night Country is incredible, I will fit in it as part of next week's episode, I imagine. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. To the people who have commented on our pages about Night Country, I appreciate it. If you want to send messages to the page or you want to join our supporter group, I'll put a link in the show notes where you can talk to me and the other people in that community directly who really help build these episodes. I bounce ideas off of, they bounce ideas off of me. It's a really cool, close-knit community. You're not compelled to stay. You can also just come and lurk and see what it's about and then decide to stay. I haven't seen anyone come in who's looked around and decided to leave. Like, it's a really, it's a passionate horror community, right? That's what we're all here for. But if you're in that group and you have thoughts about Night Country, I will definitely see them because I check that group 3 or 4 times a day. Also, I'll be taking suggestions for future episodes, and that's the best place to give those suggestions as well. I am committing to one of our subscribers in that group suggested to talk about the movie Life Force by Tobe Hooper, and I am definitely going to do that. I need to rewatch and do a little research. I came really late to Life Force. I saw it at a screening on a big screen for the first time. I came to it completely fresh. I wasn't the biggest Tobe Hooper fan growing up, to be honest. I loved Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1 and 2, but hadn't seen a lot of Tobe Hooper's other work at the time. And I saw this screening of Life Force, and it was one of the most fun, incredible experiences I've ever had in a theater. But I only have that one memory of it, so I need more to talk about it. But this is an example of someone made a suggestion for an episode in the supporter group, and it's going to happen here in the next month or change. All right, let's stop talking before the sun comes up in Alaska. I'll see you on the other side of Night Country. I'll see you on the other side of this. I'll see you next Wednesday. Until then, have a great and dark horror week.